Day, Lotta versus LaPorte County Sheriff's Department et al. Ms. Board.
May it please the court. I am April Board, and I'm here on behalf of the appellants Roger and Jacqueline Latta. We are here today appealing from a district court decision by the Northern District of Indiana, sitting in Hammond, Indiana, in which there was a grant of summary judgment to the defendants on October 25, 2005. This case arises from a Civil Rights Section 1983 complaint that the plaintiffs filed on February 5, 2003. An amended complaint was subsequently filed. Actually, a second amended complaint was subsequently filed, adding as defendants a group of defendants, Barker and Herbert Laboratories. The initial February 5 complaint named various entities of the prosecutor, Walter Chapala at the time, Scott During, who was the deputy prosecutor, Mike Mollenhauer, which was a police officer for LaPorte County itself, Arlen Boyd, the state fire marshal's office, and various defendants. Pertinent to this appeal are the group of Barker and Herbert defendants that were subsequently added, as well as certain LaPorte County defendants and certain state defendants, namely Arlen Boyd, state police officer, Walter Chapala, prosecutor, Scott During, the deputy prosecutor. Criminal case itself arose from the convictions of Roger and Jacqueline Latta that occurred as a result of a Valentine's Day fire in 1989. In that fire, in that home fire, that residential fire, their son, their two-year-old son, Brad, perished, and they were unable to save their son. They were subsequently convicted of felony murder in LaPorte County on April 14, 1990. Their criminal convictions were subsequently affirmed by the Indiana 4th District Court of Appeals, and their post-conviction relief petitions denied on February 9, 1999. On appeal of the denial of post-conviction relief, the Indiana Appellate Court ruled that a conflict of interest existed in the joint representation of the Lattas. This was subsequently affirmed by the Indiana Supreme Court on March 16, 2001. In reaching its finding, the Indiana Supreme Court overturned, based upon the ineffective assistance of counsel and the joint representation, as the Lattas had been represented by the same criminal defense attorney. However, in their opinion, they found plausible certain other issues that were raised, but they did not reach those issues, as they were able to overturn the case based upon the ineffective assistance of counsel. The case was remanded for a new trial, and my clients were out on bail June 1st, 2001, and remained out on bail until the prosecutor at the time subsequently elected to dismiss the charges on August 23rd, 2003. The appellants contend that the defendants violated their constitutional rights under the Fourth and Fourteenth Amendment, along with violations of due process and equal protection. The issues before this court today are whether the district court erred in its grant of summary judgment. We believe that there were multiple facts that were in conflict that precluded the entry on certain fronts of the district court's judgment. There's been multiple versions of what happened and whether the chromatograms were inculpatory or exculpatory. Somewhat unique that I believe in this case is that this stems from an arson. And arson is unlike a bank robbery, a drug charge. It has certain elements that if you do not have a qualified investigator and you don't have qualified people in place at the time that a fire occurs, unfortunately, the evidence is going to be forever lost. Key to this appeal, though, I think we have to reach the statute of limitations arguments before we get to some of the other more meaty subjects, and in particular with the Barker and Herbert defendants. In this case, the plaintiffs did bring conspiracy claims and claims of withholding exculpatory evidence timely, within 2 years of when the Indiana Supreme Court overturned their convictions. However, the Barker and Herbert defendants were added some time later. The district court found that the plaintiffs did not argue that in their brief that it would necessarily imply the invalidity of their convictions and thereby invoke the Heck versus Humphrey. We would respectfully disagree with this finding, as we felt that we did address it on pages 33 and 34 of the VAR brief in response to Barker and Herbert's motion for summary judgment. In fact, we stated that the sum and substance of a wrongful conviction and imprisonment claim, the denial of the right to a fair trial, necessarily implies the invalidity. You would have to deal with that issue before your claim would accrue. Further, the district court went on to make a finding that the chromatograms were, in fact, inculpatory versus exculpatory, which we believe was a material issue of fact. We believe that the evidence showed that there was a conspiracy that would have fraudulently concealed and told the statute of limitations, and we also believe that the equitable tolling doctrine applies in this case. Because they brought, you know, on appeal, and I'll try to explain it this way, on appeal, they knew that the chromatograms had been withheld. And the public defender, Hope Fay, was able to successfully subpoena them from Barker and Herbert, and that was dealt with on appeal in their criminal convictions. However, my clients, when they filed this original Section 1983 litigation, had no reason to believe that it was Barker and Herbert that had, in fact, withheld the chromatograms. They believed that it was at the hands of the prosecution. And as a result, did not initially name Barker and Herbert and their chemist and their lab technicians as defendants, as they believed that we needed to have a good faith belief as to the defendants we were bringing into court. However, once the discovery and the box was received from the prosecution and the subpoenas went out to Barker and Herbert and the documents, and you begin to look at the memos and you begin to look at the letters and the correspondence and what had actually occurred in the case, it became very apparent that there had been an agreement, a willful agreement, between Barker and Herbert and the prosecution to not produce those chromatograms.
And that is sort of supposition, isn't it? Because in terms of specific evidence of that, and when you look at your brief, you don't really cite to the record at all what the evidence was to support the conspiracy. I mean, I understand those are your conclusions, but there's no specific evidence of that conspiracy, is it?
Well, we would respectfully disagree, Your Honor. We did cite to numerous letters and correspondence between the prosecution and Barker and Herbert, that Barker and Herbert, the prosecution was directing them. They call them, they say, and they admit this in their depositions, you know, do you want us to, what do you want us to produce? And all well knowing, as we cited to in Craig Balliot's deposition, he knew that he looked at the subpoena. He knew what they were asking for was the chromatograms. His own wife testified that Craig would have known that they were requesting the chromatograms and why. She testified that that was the case. She is a lab technician, and him, as well qualified as he was, knew that without that evidence, there was no way that the defense could critique his claim or their claim of a match between the Lady Lee charcoal lighter fluid and the one sample that allegedly tested positive BHAL1. And in our underlying briefs, we attached as exhibits that correspondence, that subpoena, those depositions of Craig Balliot, the depositions of Margaret Balliot. Those were all things that the defense was not privy to, not in the criminal prosecution, not privy to on appeal. Those are protected by work product, by the thoughts and impressions of attorneys and their experts. In addition, this case is a little bit different than Buckley. With respect to this case, there was a willful hiding of evidence. And as a result, that they should not be protected for the willful hiding. Now, I'll try to stay focused with respect to the, I guess my point was, and I'll try to bring it back, is that when my clients had a reasonable belief to know that Barker and Herbert had been a willful participant in this, and they saw all the documents and they saw the letters that they were not privy to, it became quite apparent what had happened. The district court found that Roger Ladder knew or reasonably should have known because he had suspicions at the time of the trial that he always questioned in his mind what had happened. District court said, as of the date of the trial, he should have known or reasonably should have known that his rights were violated. We would respectfully disagree with that, Your Honor, that that's a material issue of fact. He said was, I questioned it because I knew that the fire was not, when I was in the house, the fire was not where they claimed that they found the accelerant. I never thought that was right. He questioned it because he knew what he had seen. That does not rise to the level of knew or reasonably should have known. At the very least, it should be an issue before the jury to determine whether he knew or reasonably should have known at that point based on that evidence, as the plaintiffs did come forward with evidence to the contrary. Further, the court relied heavily on Smith versus Gonzalez in finding that the Barker and Herbert defendants, that the statute of limitations were not met. We would submit to the court that in Smith, that the court in that case specifically found that there was a Brady violation in overturning the conviction. That was not the case here. And that, of course, the court required that they turn over the evidence, therefore a future Brady violation could not occur, and therefore the defendant should be on notice that it triggered his mechanism for the reasonable time period to file. This was a conspiracy, would be our allegations, and we believe the evidence shows, and we believe that that sets it apart from the Smith versus Gonzalez, because they did timely file their Brady claims, the withholding of exculpatory evidence within the 2-year time period. As to the defendants, they knew that they did it, but and then did file within a reasonable, equitable time. I'd also like to quickly reach the Nygren or under the color of state law issue for the district court, in which they relied strongly on the Nygren case. In our case, of course, we contend that there was a private individual and a state official that reached an understanding to deprive a person of his constitutional rights, and that the private individual was a willful participant in a joint activity with the state or its agent. We feel that the district court erred in not looking at the facts most favorable to the plaintiffs and in resolving material issues of facts centering around whether the defense's subpoena actually requested the chromatograms. The court found, in our case, that the subpoena didn't actually request the chromatograms, therefore, then you couldn't scream foul. But that completely ignores the testimony of Craig Balliot, who said that when he was showed the subpoena, what does this ask for? It asks for the chromatograms, ignores the testimony of his wife. Would like to differentiate Nygren as it involved a private actor hiring a private lab. And the court in Nygren specifically found that there was no connection between the state and this private lab. Therefore, they couldn't be acting under color of state law. We think our facts in this case are distinctly different than that. We have a state actor in the prosecutor's office hiring this private lab to perform the test results on fire scene samples. We have the lab coming to trial and saying, no, we were paid by auto owners. But in fact, later finding out, in this case, there were receipts. There was county records reflecting their payment. So we believe that there is that significant connection between the state and the private lab, which really significantly differentiates it from the Nygren case. And we believe that that was in error by the district court, respectfully. I'd also like to reach, and I know I'm running out of time, quickly, the qualified immunity issue with respect to Walter Chapala. The district court did not grant him absolute immunity, but instead granted him qualified immunity for his pretrial activities and his direction in the investigation. The threshold question in a qualified immunity defense is whether, given the facts taken in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, there is any merit to the underlying constitutional claim. In this case, we believe that it is abundant. We have Walter Chapala before the smoke even clears. As a prosecutor and an attorney and a prosecutor that's tried arson cases, who knows how fact-sensitive a fire scene investigation is, before the smoke clears, claiming that this is an arson. This was not a case that was automatically an arson. This is a case that should have been fully and fairly investigated.
Then exactly what constitutional right are you saying was violated by his actions?
The denial to the right to a fair trial. My clients were deprived of any ability to have a fair trial because once Chapala said that, once Mollenhauer started, then the evidence was gone. It was gone at the time that John Walker went there. And it completely deprived him. If they'd had the space heater, could have had testing on it. If they could have had, if they would have got up in the attic and taken pictures, if they would have investigated the electrical wiring, there'd just been an electrical fire in that attic some months prior. There was a rekindle and a fire at the time when they were doing the cause and origin investigation and had to send the volunteer fire department up to put it out at that time. But because Trumbala, who would have clearly known that there should have been a right to how important a fair investigation in this case would be, because he knew that, and that right was clearly established to have the right to a fair trial. You can't just blindly turn your eye, claim it's an arson, and everybody follows in your footsteps. It's clear that a person of authority would recognize that that is likely to happen, and it did, in fact, did happen in this case.
Could you speak, if you would, to your concerns about the confession?
My concerns regarding Jacqueline Ladd's confession are significant. I think that they clearly violated the due process rights. I think they're conscience shocking. We have a mother in less than 24 hours who's told by the police that she and her husband must come to the fire station to report a fire. We have a mother that hasn't slept. We have a mother that hasn't ate. We have a mother that's on hallucinogenic drugs. We have a mother that is visibly upset and beside herself, as I can't even imagine, and who is consistent despite all of it for the first several hours of the interrogation. Out comes the initial two officers, and in comes Arlen Boyd, slapping the table, accusing her of being a cold-blooded murderer, telling her that her husband is recounting a version of a set fire and how it was. They have the gas can. They have the fingerprints. They have the proof. She doesn't believe she's free to leave the room. She believes she's at the station because she's required to be at the station. She didn't walk in that day thinking that. And she was in no mental state, interestingly. Doesn't make the officer's report that she's on medication that has hallucinogenic effects. Doesn't make the report that he's slapping the table and coercing her. And in that report, it's clear that this woman was a woman that was out of her mind. That by the time Boyd got done with her and the police trickery and the good guy, bad guy cops, that she didn't know which end was up. And what mother, what parent doesn't feel some guilt? They played upon that. Boyd played upon that until he got her to make quasi-admissions that because her conscience and her free will were overborne. I believe that that is conscience shocking, and I agree that due process is one of the stingiest constitutional rights, and I understand why that is in play. But if you look at the overwhelming totality of the circumstances of a young mother who's uneducated, has no money, is living in a rental house, there's no life insurance, and she loses her 2-year-old son, I can't imagine a situation that would be more conscience shocking.
You want to reserve some time for a rebuttal?
Thank you.
Ms. Barrow.
May it please the court. The district court properly entered summary judgment in favor of the three state defendants. As to these defendants, the court found that the undisputed facts did not support the plaintiff's inferences, that those facts show
counsel,
that...
Counsel, is the sheriff's department a proper party in this case?
Is a sheriff's department? I don't know.
Are you not representing them?
No, I am sorry. I'm representing Walter Chapala and Scott Dering and Arlen Boyd. The claim against Walter Chapala is that he came to the scene and declared the fire to be an arson and that that colored the entire investigation. The record shows that he received a phone call early in the morning on February, it would have been the 15th, was told by the sheriff's department, there was a fire, there was a death, we think it's arson. He arrives at the scene. The investigators are there. The fire marshal is there. They are saying, we think it's an arson. He looks for himself and agrees. And that's it. He participates in meetings surrounding the investigation. There's no evidence that he told anybody who to talk to, what evidence to photograph, what evidence to consider, how to carry on the investigation. They are simply assuming, because of his role as the prosecutor, that somehow he improperly caused the other people to do their jobs improperly. And that does not support their claim that he denied their right to a fair investigation, that he denied their right to a fair trial. And so the district court properly held that he was entitled to qualified immunity. Scott During was the prosecutor who actually tried the case. All of the allegations against this defendant were in regard to his role as an advocate, a quasi-judicial role that is entitled to absolute immunity under the Supreme Court's decision in Imbler versus Pacman. Accordingly, the only disputed facts that the plaintiffs have alleged with regard to the state defendants, these chromatograms, all of this arises under this defendant's role as a prosecutor. He actually believed that this evidence was inculpatory, but because he has absolute prosecutorial immunity, this court needn't reach that particular factual contention. And under this court's opinion in Houston versus Partee, a prosecutor acting as an advocate trying the case is entitled to absolute immunity. The third defendant that I'm representing, Arlen Boyd, was a state police detective. The district court properly held that Boyd did not coerce Jacqueline Latta's confession, did not violate her right against self-incrimination or her equal protection rights. The inquiry into the confession is, well, does the totality of the circumstances demonstrate that the confession was a product of rational intellect, not the result of physical abuse or intimidation or deceptive tactics calculated to overcome the defendant's free will? Jacqueline Latta was 27 years old. She had a high school education. There was no evidence that she had low intelligence. Although she had taken tranquilizers, there was no evidence that that affected her behavior.
Is that what is reflected by the prison records of her intelligence?
According to the depositions, there was no evidence that she was of unusually low intelligence so that she would not be able to form or to rationally respond to the questions.
Can you review the timing of this interview?
Yes, the timing. Interestingly, Arlen Boyd first talked to the Lattas on February 15. He realized that they were tired and they were distraught from the fire. He said to them, come to the station tomorrow, and that's what they did. They came on the 16th. Arlen Boyd was, I think, the second or third law enforcement to question them. They had already been at the station for some time.
And that's what I mean, that for
yes.
some time. How long
yes,
is that?
Yes, I believe 4 hours.
And so they were together at that point.
That was when
during
he...
During that four-hour period.
Roger was in one part of the station, Jacqueline in another. And so Arlen Boyd started out with the interrogation of Roger, and then he went upstairs and started talking to Jacqueline. He was with her for a period of about an hour. During that time, his deposition testimony is that she did appear distraught at the point when he said, I think you're lying. I think you set the fire. Here's what Roger said. We know you did it. Tell us what really happened. And she did get distraught. When asked, did she appear to be hysterical or did she appear to be out of her mind? Did she appear confused? He said no. She was just emotional. And that's what he would expect under the circumstances. She had also been given her Miranda rights. She had signed a waiver of those rights. There was no violation of her Fifth Amendment right. She had been told she's entitled to an attorney. At several points, she thought, well, maybe I should have a lawyer. Arlen Boyd says, well, that means I have to stop talking to you. And she said, well, don't stop. Stay. And she continued talking. There was no clear request for an attorney where he would be required to stop questioning her. I see that my time is up. I would ask this court to affirm entry of summary and judgment for the three state defendants. Thank you.
Mr. Lauer?
May it please the court, I'm here on behalf of the defendants, LaPorte County and Mike Mullenauer. The Sheriff's Department of LaPorte County was initially named as a defendant in this case, but they were dismissed. Mr. Mullenauer is an employee of the Sheriff's Department, or I should say LaPorte County, and he was a captain at the time of the investigation and also the fire investigator. I'm also here with my co-counsel, Shaw Friedman, who's at the table.
You say the Sheriff's Department was dismissed, but here they are as the lead defendant in this appeal, and an appeal has been taken. Are they a proper party?
Well, Judge, I don't think they're a proper party, and we argued that if you look at the plaintiff's brief or the Latta's brief, I don't think there's any mention in their four claims against LaPorte County and Mike Mullenauer. There's no specific claim in their brief against the Sheriff's Department. Their issues address LaPorte County and Mike Mullenauer. And so, but in the district court's decision, I think the Sheriff's Department was dismissed from this case.
So was everybody else. That's why the plaintiffs are appealing.
Correct. I would like, though, to address initially the conspiracy claims with respect to all of the defendants. The district court found that there was that the Lattas did not have any objective evidence to indicate a conspiracy. And I think that's important here. To show a conspiracy, you have to have an express or implied agreement, and you also have to have an actual deprivation of those rights in the form of an overt act. And when I say an express or implied agreement, it has to be to deprive the plaintiffs of a constitutional right. In this case, they allege their right to a fair trial. Looking at the evidence, especially pages 50 and 51, 52 of the brief of the Lattas, there's no mention of any specific agreement. There's no meeting of all these defendants to get together and to deprive the Lattas of a fair trial. Instead, the conspiracy allegations rest on a couple things. One is the fact that the defendants in this case arrived at two conclusions. The first conclusion was that the fire was caused by arson. The second conclusion was that the Lattas were the primary suspects. Now, that is not sufficient to create a conspiracy claim against these defendants. It happens every day. And if the court, if this was to be a valid conspiracy claim, they're going to have to show much more, an actual agreement. Otherwise, any police force, any investigators could be subject to these Section 1983 conspiracy claims just for doing their job. And that's what happened in these cases. There was sufficient evidence from the investigators, from the scene of the accident, to conclude that the Lattas were the primary suspects. And some of this is from the reports done by the investigators at the scene. Other evidence comes from the Latta's own admissions. Mr. Latta gave information to investigators that during the course of the fire, he was in the room three different times, and a couple times very close to his son's bed, right next to him. Mrs. Latta gave information that she was in this room one time during the course of the fire, close to the son's bed. But because of the intensity of the heat, they were not able to get their son from the bed. Not because they were on fire, but the intensity of the heat. It's admissions like this, excluding the so-called confession here, that caused the investigators to believe that the Lattas were the primary suspects. And so it's not only what they found, the burn patterns on the floor, but these admissions. And the other basis for this conspiracy claim is the so-called mounds of circumstantial evidence that they recite on pages 51 and 52 of their brief. if you look at it, they're playing a cat and mouse game, question and answer. You know, they're really questioning the investigative techniques. They're not showing any agreement or any conspiracy. As I think Judge Williams says, a lot of this, I mean, she used the word supposition. That's what they're engaging in here, supposition, speculation. They want you to make this leap of faith, so to speak, that there was some sort of grand conspiracy. Without this conspiracy, their claims, their 1983 claims, fall like a house of cards. And, you know, that takes me to the next section. They accuse Detective Molinaro in LaPorte County of violating their due process rights. And they list those on page 42. You know, if you put them together, they're primarily issues or questions with respect to how our client, my client, and the other defendants conducted the investigation. However, these citations do not rise to the level of a constitutional violation. They're really prophylactic rules. They're not violations of constitutional rights to a fair trial. As such, they're as prophylactic rules. You know, you have situations where policemen conduct an investigation, and they don't do it the way the defendant wants. It's the defendant's job then at trial to point that out. I think it's very important here that if we even assume for a second the defendants have a valid argument, it's really a negligence argument. There's no showing of deliberate indifference in this case by any of the defendants, and there's no violation of any constitutional rights by any of the defendants. My last statement is that the district court found that the defendants, in fact, the Lattas, are not entitled to the perfect investigation. Once you reach probable cause, that's sufficient. They don't have to, the defendants in this case did not have to consider other motives or causes for the fire.
Were they charged with arson?
Yes, they were charged with arson.
And were they found guilty of that?
Yes.
And felony murder?
It wasn't felony murder, correct, I think. I realize my time is up. I would ask that the court reaffirm the district court's decision based on the rest of our brief. Thank you.
Thanks, Laura. Barner?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Larry Barnard, and I represent Barker and Herbert Analytical Laboratories, John Walker, and Craig Ballier. I'll start with this. The one more name we haven't heard today, and nor is it a name mentioned anywhere in the argument sections of the briefs of the appellant in this case, is John Walker. There's absolutely no basis for any claims against John Walker in this case. And, in fact, the Lattas have made no arguments with respect to John Walker in their briefs in this matter, so it can be beyond dispute that the district court properly entered summary judgment in favor of Mr. Walker on the claims asserted against him in this case. Now, the district court did enter summary judgment on four distinct grounds in favor of the Barker and Herbert defendants. First, the statute of limitations. Second, absolute immunity for the testimony of Walker and Ballier. Third, there was no color of state law proven. And fourth, there was no evidence presented to establish a Monell claim against Barker and Herbert as an entity. To prevail in this action, in this appeal, the plaintiffs are going to have to, in fact, win all of these arguments, at least with respect to Barker and Herbert, and the three of the four with respect to Craig Ballier and John Walker. It is our position that the appellants have failed to demonstrate reversible error on any of those issues. With respect to the issue of the statute of limitations, in this case, there's more than just evidence that, well, the Lattas had a few suspicions. A review of the deposition testimony of Roger and Jacqueline Lattas say a lot more than that. Roger Latta testified that he knew by the time he was released from prison about the questions concerning the testing of the samples by Barker and Herbert. He knew that John Walker had allegedly conducted an inadequate investigation. He knew that Barker and Herbert failed to provide his attorney with the testing of samples at the time he was released from prison more than 3 years or approximately 3 years prior to the time that the Barker and Herbert defendants were added by the second amended complaint. The facts are the same with Jacqueline Latta. She knew either at the time of trial or certainly at the time of the filing of the request for post-conviction relief of all of the bases for the claims against Walker, Ballier, and Barker and Herbert in this case. The appellants would say, well, they testified that they had suspicions or they felt. Well, I don't know what else is necessary. Certainly, they didn't have to have all the evidence necessary to prevail in the case in order to know or reasonably should have known that their constitutional rights had allegedly been violated by the Barker and Herbert defendants. Certainly, those things all occurred more than 2 years prior to filing the second amended complaint. In their briefs, the plaintiffs also, the appellants raise issues concerning Heck versus Humphrey. Mm-hmm. Heck versus Humphrey simply says, as long as you have an outstanding conviction, you can't collaterally attack it by filing a Section 1983 action. There was no outstanding conviction once the Indiana Supreme Court vacated.
What do you think is the effect on that question of the Supreme Court's grant of certiorari in Wallace against Chicago?
Your Honor, I guess I don't know what the effect of that question is going to be until the Supreme Court has an opportunity to decide that case.
I found it puzzling that everyone here is discussing the limitations question without any attention to our holding in Wallace, let alone to the grant.
Well, in Wallace, Your Honor, this court dealt specifically with the question of a false arrest. And so that's not directly applicable to the claims against my clients being non-governmental entities who were in no way involved with the arrest of the lattice. However, I think the Wallace case draws a bright line test as opposed to the prior opinions of this court that could be viewed as, well, we need to look instead as to whether or not the evidence that was obtained as a result of the false arrest would have been inadmissible and there wouldn't have been a conviction without that evidence. So it doesn't directly apply to my clients. However, I think it shows that there needs to be something more here. And in this case, once their convictions were reversed...
Well, one might think the rationale of Wallace isn't limited to false arrests. On the rationale of Wallace, essentially every claim in this case is barred by the statute of limitations because things that occur before trial on the rationale of Wallace are independently litigable. The Supreme Court's holding, we concluded in Wallace, applies only to the events at trial. And, of course, the events at trial are covered by immunity. But I was wondering what one thought about the grant of certiorari, about whether that makes it prudent or imprudent for us to rely on Wallace in the interim. Or should we perhaps hold this case pending the outcome of Wallace?
Your Honor, of course, I would take the position it would be prudent for this court to consider Wallace in connection with the decision in this case. However, even to the extent that Wallace is called into question by the grant of certiorari, even under the case law as it existed prior to Wallace, the plaintiff's claims are barred against my clients.
We're not going to apply any case law. If we have to rule on that question, we will wait till the Supreme Court decides.
Well, Your Honor, under Heck versus Humphrey, it's clear that the claims are barred. Heck versus Humphrey simply says you can't collaterally attack an outstanding criminal judgment. There was no outstanding criminal judgment. And in this case, as in the Smith case, which was relied on in the district court, there was no chance, at least with respect to the claims against my clients, that that there could be any question concerning this matter at a retrial. By the time the Supreme Court reversed the convictions of the lattice counsel had the chromatograms. So in a retrial, there could be no question about the chromatograms not being supplied. They had them already. There could be no pseudo Brady violations by my clients with respect to any retrial. So, Your Honor, I don't believe it's necessary to wait for the Supreme Court to rule under the clear existing precedent of the Supreme Court. My clients are entitled to judgment as a matter of law on that issue. However, in addition to that issue, my clients were also properly granted summary judgment on the issue of absolute immunity. The court properly determined that Balliet and Walker were immune from all liability, not only for their testimony, but for their actions taken leading up to that testimony. For these reasons and the reasons set forth in the briefs, Your Honor, we believe that the judgment of the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Indiana should be affirmed in its entirety.
Thank you, Mr. Bernard.
Thank you.
Ms. Ward?
Thank you.
I would like to address Wallace. I think that's a keen question from Justice Easterbrook or Judge Easterbrook. I would urge, and think it was said very well in that case as well by Judge Posner in his dissent, in that case, that when he said and quoted the Sixth Circuit's reasoning, just as a convicted prisoner must first seek relief through a habeas corpus before his Section 1983 cause of action can accrue, so too should the defendant in a criminal proceeding focus on his primary mode of relief, mounting a viable defense to the charges against them before turning to a civil claim under Section 1983.
So do you think we should hold off till Wallace is decided?
I would urge the court to do so. There's already an inter-circuit conflict, and Judge Posner feels that this Seventh Circuit has even a differing view from the circuit split. I believe there does need to be some consensus for claimants, for attorneys, for courts, with respect to this issue. While both sides, I can see, have merit, there needs to be a consistent ruling, and I would urge this court to wait until Wallace is decided. I also believe, and I would be happy to submit this to the court, in question on Judge Flom to were the Lattice convicted of arson as well. I will be happy to check that and would be happy to submit post-brief argument, but I believe, as I recall the record, that they were convicted solely of felony murder.
That's what I thought, but I from the briefs, but I...
As I recall, and I...
I think counsel... In a case of this magnitude, would be aware, all counts would be aware of that, but whatever, the record is what it is.
And I would like to, Judge Williams, I would also like to indicate that it was my belief that Roger and Jacqueline, the record reflects that they were separated from the time they walked into the station until they were allowed to leave that station that day.
So you agree, though, that she was just questioned for that hour? That it was the husband who was questioned before, that's why I was interested.
No, I absolutely disagree. They were both being questioned in opposite parts of the station by differing officers during the entirety of that time period. She was not questioned for just an hour. The Boyd's questioning was for just an hour. A little over, it may have been an hour and a half. There was some differing. They arrived at the station at 1:30 and Officer Schott and Officer Yadavia from the Michigan City Police Department initially questioned Jacqueline Latter for two and a half hours and came out and told Officer Boyd that her statement had been consistent and that she had not made any admissions that would implicate her in any way. At that time, during that same time period, Officer Boyd had been downstairs interrogating Roger Latter, and when that didn't yield any admissions, he came upstairs, and after being told by Officer Schott and Yadavia of the situation, he insisted that he go in alone and speak with her. And it was during this additional one to one and a half hours of questioning that was the only alleged admissions. And interestingly, Roger's statement was taped and Jackie's was not, for no apparent reason. But it was much longer than just an hour, Judge.
About a total of a little over 3 hours?
I believe it was over four.
Four?
I believe about 4 hours and 10 minutes, if I am correct.
I'll have to ask you make a concluding remark.
We would just urge this court to overturn the district court's findings and reverse and remand for a new trial. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you. Thanks to all counsel. Case is taken under advisement.